Welcome back to the Pretty Serious Bike Racing Podcast, everybody. I'm Dane Cash, and we have a surprising amount of things to talk about today, even though there's no recapping of how any races were triumphed in. No Grand Tour, no World Championships. There is still a Grand Tour ahead of us, but right now we're just talking about like tune-up races and news stuff, and yet there's plenty to talk about, and we are going to preview the upcoming final Grand Tour, possibly my favorite race of the year, at least my favorite Grand Tour. I can't wait to talk about it with my bike racing analyst extraordinaire co-host Cosmo Catalano. Cosmo, good to see you.
Good to see you too, Dane.
And joining us this week, Abby Mickey. Abby, you are in Scotland. Are you home now?
I'm in Girona for the time being, so it's closer to home than Scotland.
Yeah,
at
okay.
Least.
Yeah. How you feeling?
Good. Yeah. Pretty happy to be at least a couple hours away from home and almost home after a month on the road.
Good. Yeah, that's good. Well, we have all kinds of interesting things to talk about, but first, I'm excited to tell you, if you're listening to this podcast, that we are member-funded, and you should go sign up to be one of those supporters of the Escape Collective if you haven't already. If you have, we're very grateful. And actually, there's a few of you who are signed up to be lifetime members that we're going to give a shout-out to right here. So, to Ian Howell, Mikal Kolasar, Joe Doyle, Jason Baker, and Tim Weber, a sincere thank you for being lifetime members. You are crucial to what we do here. And again, if you're not a member, you should go sign up. You should head over to escapecollective.com/join. Join the very cool community we have over here at the Escape Collective. We've got some pretty cool people in the crew of supporters, and we would just love to have you if you're not one of those people. So go check it out, escapecollective.com/join. You're supporting this podcast, all the other podcasts, including Wheel Talk, hosted by Abby Mickey, right here on this very podcast today. We're very lucky to have so many great other podcasts. It's not just me and Cosmo. So you're supporting a lot of great podcasts if you sign up. So go do it. All right, on with the show. So let's talk about some bike racing. Let's talk about bike racing that has happened first, and then we'll look ahead to the big races that are around the corner. I'm very excited, Cosmo, that we are hosting the Pretty Serious Bike Racing Podcast, because I feel like for a very long time I was just doing podcasts that weren't serious enough to talk about a race like the Bemersa Classics. Because you know Kaylee would just ignore this. He'd make fun of this race over on the placeholders. And he might in a few days. I don't know. I'll find out.
Despite its World Tour race status, the highest level of international
It is World
cycling.
Tour race. I think that's the thing. A lot of people wonder why. You know, why is a race like this World Tour? But you know what? I'm pretty serious about bike racing. We're all pretty serious about bike racing, so we can talk a little bit about the Bemersa Classics. We don't have to spend an hour on it.
The race was raced seriously by serious people. It was.
It really was.
It was
actually very entertaining.
Solid show.
Finale. Yeah. And so we're going to talk about it. I got a lot of little things to talk about with this race. So if you haven't seen the race, go check it out. There is a full replay on GCN. Mess Peterson won the race in a very interesting fashion. And let's start with that. I want to just broad point to start is that Mess Peterson is very strong right now. He just won the Tour of Denmark, which is a stage race. That's not really something he does a lot of. And then he won at the Bemersa Classics, formerly the Vattenfall, otherwise known as the Euro Eyes. They've had a lot of different
HEW, I think, was one of them.
Yeah. Which we'll get to this in a bit, how I think that's kind of dumb. Anyway, Peterson very strong right now. Peterson's team very strong right now. And I do kind of wonder, can he do this next spring? Can he get this strong for the spring so that he can take on, you know, the Vanderpool, Van Aert, Pogacar juggernaut? Because that would be cool. He's been close. He's been very close. And obviously he's won a world title as well. But this is as strong as we've seen him, I think.
Should we recap the race a little bit more broadly or no?
Yeah, why don't you tell us about his 600-meter sprint and why that happened, and
Pascal Ackermann of the UAE team was maybe one of the favorites going in, light favorite, mid favorite, session favorite, I don't know what you'd call it. But he dropped about 20K to go, and so UAE just threw strong guys at the front of the race, ended up with Brandon McNulty in a breakaway with Yves Lampaert and Nils Paulet, I think. Very strong breakaway of three. We saw some of Pollitt's teammates kind of come to the front as a catch looked like it might happen on a narrow section of road and stop pedaling. So this trio is away inside a kilometer. McNulty tried to make a move, and behind that, you saw Mads Pettersson himself, no lead out, just busting out of the field, probably around 600 or 700 meters to go. And he's kind of reeling in that trio as that trio is reeling in McNulty, and they kind of all come together under 150 meters, and you can see the rest of the bunch bearing down, extremely fast, punchy sprint at the end. Pettersson comes off of Lampaert's wheel, looks back, throws his arms up, crosses the line like milliseconds before, I think, Danny Van Poppel shoots
Danny Van
by.
Poppel, yeah.
And it's one of the Van Poppels. There's a lot of them, so I want to make sure I get the right one. But yeah, I mean, it is like, you're like, yeah, Pettersson got it. And then you're like, ooh, I don't know. It's super tight. But it was just really super strong, super confident move. And to top that off, like, not only did Pettersson do that huge effort to take the win, but earlier he had followed a bunch of attacks, kind of the only meaningful climb in the finale. Like, again, like super, like, I'm just going to go to the front of the race, sit here and pedal hard when pedaling hard needs to be done. So I would say he has tremendous potential for next spring, and I'm excited to see what happens.
Yeah, really nice win. He actually, you know, for all of his success in his career as a world champion, as a multi-time stage winner at some Grand Tours, including the Tour de France, he won the points jersey at the Vuelta last year. He actually had not won many World Tour One Days. This was only the second one after again Wevelgem. So good on him. You know, again, I'm sure it's not the biggest win from a marketing perspective. It's a World Tour race. There were some World Tour talents there.
That's debatable because their new sponsor, their new German sponsor, is going to be pretty happy about a World Tour win on German soil by the team with Lidl.
Yeah,
in
that's a really good point.
Circle.
You could see that Lidl Trek took this very seriously, and so did Bora, you know, the German team. Bora was throwing guys at the front as well. Bora had a good race. And as you know, kind of talked about in the finale there was some blocking going on at the front for a little bit. One of the many talking points here in this race that I wanted to go over really quickly because they are interesting. And actually, I wanted to take advantage of the fact that we have a former pro here with us today. We actually kind of have a former pro like almost all the time when we do a show. So I wanted to throw some questions at the former pro on the podcast. A little ask a former pro segment, or three, actually. I got three different questions for you. So there was some blocking going on by Bora. It didn't quite work out. They went to the front, didn't go very fast. It maybe helped the escapes almost stay clear. And then again, Danny Van Poppel of the Bora team actually still did finish second, very nearly pipped Pettersson at the end. So a nice race for Bora on their, you know, German home turf. But yeah, I want to talk about blocking first because it's something that we see sometimes. And I kind of always wonder, what do you do if you're any other team that's not doing that at the front? How do you get around that? How do you deal with that? Is it something that whenever it happens, you're exchanging mean words? Abby, what do you do when another team blocks at the front?
Well, I think I have been both the blocker and the blocky, and so I can say there is a sense of hilarious power that comes along with it. Like, but you have to have the team to be able to kind of back it up. So I was only successfully able to do that on UHC and then United Healthcare back in the day. And then was successfully blocked whilst on Colavita. So I feel like it really depends, and it also depends on the situation. In this situation, I feel like it was a brilliant move by Bora. I mean, Lidl Trek did such an incredible job all day for Mess. Like, they really were controlling the race from the get-go and did everything in their power to make sure that he was in the best position possible and that he could conserve himself as much as he possibly could before that final climb and the other climbs that kind of impacted the sprinters coming into that finale. And him being able to have that acceleration he had at the end, I think in large part was to the team effort. So the fact that there was no Trek riders there when that move went and that Mess wasn't there, it was when he was under the most amount of pressure. Bora knew from the beginning that he was probably the rider to beat after how he rode into the Tour of Denmark and also how he was at Worlds and how the team was backing him. And so for them to have a guy up there see Mess was farther back and block at that moment was brilliant. What was weird to me in that moment was the other teams kind of, there was a very long block of hesitation from other teams as Bora was impeding the chase. And I think it actually ended up helping Mess in the end because it meant that he could launch that move earlier on and get a head start on the sprinters because he wouldn't have won had it been a straight up sprint. So I think that while it looked like a kind of like an FU to Mess and the other sprinters, it actually worked in his favor. But it's definitely a tactic that I think has to be employed with caution because you can be the asshole very easily. Like sometimes it can be used really tactically and sometimes you're just a dick. What comes to mind was a moment in the Giro Rosa in 2016, I believe it was. There's three Bols Dolmans riders and Mara Abbott, and the three Bols Dolmans riders were just kind of like side front of Mara Abbott, just blocking every single thing that she was trying to do. And that was such a shitty tactic. I feel like today was pretty brilliant.
How do you get around that? I mean, what do you do if you're Mara Abbott?
You just get really frustrated and go, ah!
Basically, it sounds like people should do this more, but based on the fact that it doesn't sound like there's that much that you can do.
No, because it's shit. Like,
I'm not saying it's not mean.
No, but I mean, I think that there's a time and place to use this tactic, and that Bora did it super well today, but that you can't use it all the time because it's very uncool. Like, I think it sucks. You would very, very quickly gain a lot of enemies in the peloton, and cycling is a very petty sport and it is a very small world.
Right.
And you do not want to gain those enemies in the peloton.
I was going to say that it is tricky to do as well as it has been done in the cases we brought up here. Like, especially today is a good example. Like, the reason Bora was able to block is because no one wanted to quite make the catch yet. And so you had kind of some soft pedaling, and this narrow section of road came up, and they were able, because the pace wasn't full on, kind of sneak around and get those bodies in there. And so it can't just be like, you don't arbitrarily have the ability to put a bunch of people in the front and stop or slow down the race. Because usually the road is wide, or everyone is trying to go fast, or they don't mind about making a late catch. But because this is a longer race, it's a classic, everybody's kind of counting on a sprint. No one quite wanted to close that gap yet, and they took advantage of that. And that's kind of why I think you don't see it more.
All right,
I agree.
The narrowness of the course. That leads me to my next question. Ask a former pro. Ask Abby. Dear Abby, the roads today, as we're watching the race go into the finish, urban center, it's in Hamburg, which is a big city. And I'm just constantly seeing, you know, narrow streets, winding roads, tight corners. Obviously, there's lots of intersections that they're going through, even though, you know, they're going to be blocked off. But it kind of made me wonder, how do the riders always know where to go? Because there are motos in front of them most of the time, and they follow those motos usually. That doesn't always lead them on the right road. It usually does. But if you're in the race, I mean, are you always just following the motos? Are you constantly looking around wondering, wait, did I miss a turn? To me, it felt like in this particular urban environment where there were so many potential turns that could be made. I mean, if you're out in the country, it's a different story. But it just seemed like this would be a confusing place, and yet the riders always know where to go. How does that happen?
Well, in a city environment, a lot of the times the other ways to go are barriered off. So it would be quite painful to try to go a different direction than the way that the course goes. It depends how fast the race is going, but also when you go through a city, a lot of the time that's when radios really come into play, which is why I will always advocate for radios to be in racing, because to me, I don't see them as a tactical tool, more as a safety tool. So radios are huge when you're going through a city. A lot of times the directors will just be coaching you through, like, where, if there's a roundabout coming up, if there's railroad tracks, if there's a bus blocking the road, something like that, then they're saying that on the radio constantly, so you always know what to expect. It's also really just the front of the race that has to worry about these things. Like, the top 5-10 people, because when you get to like 11th wheel, you're just following the person in front of you. So if the first person were to go off course, it would probably be chaos, but it's usually like once you get farther back in the peloton, you don't really have to worry about where you're going. You just kind of follow the flow of the race. But yeah, it's in a city environment like we saw on Sunday, the roads are barriered off where the riders shouldn't be going. And the moto, for the most part, like the moto will always lead the way, but you're not always watching the moto. Between the radio and the barriers, that's what's telling you where to go.
All right. I have one more question for you, Abby.
Cool.
Why do people celebrate too soon? Why did Mads Pedersen not just wait like literally a nanosecond? Why does Julian Alaphilippe do this every month? I don't understand. is it taught to you as a child that you have to be posting up for the photo every time? Help me understand.
I can't help you here because I have never done that. I feel that Ruth Winder is a really good one to ask because she won when Demi Vollering celebrated too early.
Yes.
So I feel like I should defer this answer to Ruth. But also in the case of Mess, I think it was pretty clear that he had it.
Was it though?
Yeah, I think it was. I mean, yeah, for us, we're watching at home and it looks really close. But when you're crossing the finish line, you know if you've won. Like, I think there's definitely instances where you get a little overexcited and celebrate too early. But I think it was pretty clear watching it that Mess won this. And maybe he was a little bit, maybe he was skeptical for a second, like after he saw the rest of the peloton coming so quickly behind him. But like, there was no question when you watched it back.
Yeah, that's true. When you watched it back, it was much clearer. I think part of the problem was the number of lines, like literally there were painted lines on the
really,
road.
That may have been why he was confused, because there was a bajillion lines on the road and I couldn't tell what the finish line was.
I think Rob Hatch said there were six. So there was a finish line, but then there were also these like stylized, I don't even know what the point of them was.
I think they were logos.
They were sponsorship logos.
Not a good place for it.
I think a lot of the appearance of closeness was just also the huge differential in speed, which is obvious from, you know, big shot where you're looking at everything. But like when you're in the group, you're kind of like, like Abby said, I feel like you have at least, you know, in Cat 3 racing, I've definitely seen some close sprints, but it's like you kind of know. I don't know. It's hard to describe. People do get caught on the line all the time, but I'm almost certain Pedersen like looked down back behind his legs to see what the status of the group was in terms of catching him.
Yeah, and I guess he's not a known, you know, repeat multi-offender like Alaphilippe.
He's not Alaphilippe, who
just...
Oh, that Liège finish. It was just...
Although it didn't matter in the end, because he did get relegated, but
yes,
anyway.
Yes, but I mean, it was lost on so many levels. He lost it so many different times in this much. It's like, great race, throw it out the window.
All right, Abby is charging. She's plugging in her computer, which means now's a great time for me to talk about the extremely talented Toms Skuinch, who this weekend when he finished in the top 10 of the Tour of Denmark, I was already thinking, man, he looks so fast right now. And then he was a key supporter in a big Trek win, Lidl Trek win at the Bemerset Classics today. Toms, just really, we're very impressed.
Do you hype him up when I'm not on the podcast?
Well, that's what I'm saying. You're not around to tell us, to tone it down. Where I can just hype him without any concern for that, you know?
We don't randomly shout him out unless he does some cool stuff. But he does.
That's true.
Cool
So. We do shout him out when he does cool stuff.
You know what's cool is that he's currently ranked 42nd in the world.
That's really cool, actually. UCI points?
Yeah, UCI points.
Man, good for Toms. Yeah. I wonder where let's check the good old fashioned PCS rankings. It's just because I have that right in front of me. I always have, you know, when we're talking about people.
I think he's 60th.
He's up to 49 after this week.
Square number.
Yeah. So take that. Man, look at all the big names below him in the rankings. Good on Toms.
Yeah, it's pretty rad.
Yeah. Good on Thomas. Good on Little Trek. And just imagine they're going to have even more money now to go sign more big names. And yeah, I would imagine that things are going to be looking up over there. Also,
oh,
Taylor
man,
Gegenhart.
I mean, have you been keeping up with the constant stream of new riders coming into Little Trek for next year?
Yeah. Well, Gegenhart's the big one. Yeah.
It's very exciting.
It's going to be, yeah, it's going to be cool to see what they can do in the GC department. All right. I feel like we have talked enough about the Bemmer Sick Classics, unless my co-hosts have anything else to say. All right. That was the big World Tour race, quote-unquote, big World Tour race over the weekend. The Vuelta a Burgos also happened in Spain, not a World Tour race on the men's side, but a big marker for a specific rider to have laid down before an even bigger race in Spain. I'm talking about Primoz Roglic. He took two stage wins and the overall title ahead of Alexander Vlasov and Adam Yates. Roglic looks really good ahead of the Vuelta a España, which is a race that he's won a few times, three to be exact. And we are going to talk all about the Vuelta in this podcast because it's coming up. But first, before we preview any of the races coming up, there's also the Tour of Scandinavia on the women's side. I do want to ask Abby a quick question here. Maybe we can throw over to another podcast this week to get more in depth on this. But Abby, what's going on with the EF women's teams? Can you give us a quick explainer, and then maybe if people want more, they can go listen to Wheel Talk.
That's a great question, Dane, and I'm so glad you asked. I am very confused by what's going on. I think a lot of people are. Yeah. But basically, so the two teams were separate. EF Education first came on board to sponsor TIBCO SVB in 2022, and that the extra funding made it possible for them to obtain a World Tour license. So they had a World Tour license for 2 years, and then starts the relegation battle, which is another extremely confusing thing that I don't really want to talk about, but does matter in this instance. So going into 2024, all the World Tour licenses get shuffled, kind of, and thanks to the relegation battle, and EF Education decided, look, we're going to start our own women's team. Part of it was because TIBCO and Silicon Valley Bank are no longer sponsoring TIBCO SVB in 2024 due to the collapse of that bank, which was worldwide news. And so EF pulling out of that team as well meant that Linda Jackson, the former owner who's owned the team since 2008, I believe, is when she started that team, maybe 2006. A really long time that team has been around, a fixture in the U.S. scene. So without the three title sponsors, she was unable to secure any funding. So the team is folding for next year, but EF is starting their own women's team attached to their men's team. So it's going to be EF Education Cannondale. So it's not the same team, but they have four of the same riders. We don't know who we don't know who those riders are, except for Veronica Ewers, who has already been announced. They've also signed a couple new riders. Corinne Lebecki is one of those, which is a really exciting move. But because they're a brand new team, it means that they are not eligible for a World Tour license. So they're starting on the continental level for next year, albeit with some pretty impressive talent.
And we should point out, if you're somebody who doesn't know about all the UCI's designations, or maybe you know that the continental is lower, but on the men's side, there is a intervening designation. On the women's side, continental doesn't quite mean all the way down third division. So there's only two divisions, and a lot of continental teams race the biggest races. That's not the case on the men's side. If you're on a continental team, you will not go to a World Tour race. So it's different on the women's side. So they'll still be in plenty of big races next year, you would assume, particularly with Veronica Ewers and Corinne Lebecki on the team.
You'd think, yeah. And I mean, it'll be interesting to see what races the team does get into, but at the same time, there's a bunch of World Tour teams kind of merging / not really hacking it at the World Tour level. So yeah, I think they'll get into all the big races.
All right, the obvious question is, why is EF starting a new team and not just investing in the team that they already sponsored? If the answer is too complicated to say here, though, Abby, you could just tell us where else our listeners might go for that sort of information?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I will find out the answer, or at least try to come up with something interesting before the Wheel Talk podcast comes out.
Aren't you recording that like tomorrow?
Correct.
All right. Well, no pressure. Okay.
I have two people to fall back on, Lauren Rowney and Gracie Elvin. They are very much in the know. So
that helps.
Hopefully they can help me.
All right. So there's that. Stay tuned for more. We've obviously got plenty of coverage of that over at escapecollective.com. And yeah, listen to Wheel Talk. All right. Let's look ahead at the races coming up before we close things out. So the final Grand Tour of the year is coming up. It's one of my favorite races. I'm very excited about it. Cosmo, we've said this about 7 times, although never on this specific podcast, because you and I have done this in other places in the past. I think the Vuelta's start list is almost always better than the Giro's, and it deserves more love. I don't like the fact that people write it off because they're tired of bike racing, because who gets tired of bike racing?
It's after the Tour de France, maybe more than...
Whatever. Bike racing is the best, and I want to see Primoz Roglic and Jonas Vingegaard and Remco Evenepoel doing battle. I'm going to get that opportunity at the upcoming Vuelta a España. So we're going to do a little course recon, a little recon of the start list. Not a full on, not a full 40 minutes on the subject. We got other things to talk about today that, you know, we made time for. But just a little brief look at the route. I think in general, this route actually reminds me a lot of the Tour de France route, which had widely spread out challenges. You don't have to wait till the third week to get the action in this race. There's going to be some action pretty early on at the Vuelta. That's actually relatively normal for the Vuelta, that they don't wait that long. But they have some serious climbs in the early goings. The first big GC day, though, was actually on the first day, which will unfortunately, the one blemish on what is otherwise a great race, be a team time trial. So if you like cool photos of time trial bikes, I'm sure you'll be very happy.
Love a team time trial. Don't be that
way. If you like any team that's not like one of the top three teams having any chance at all in the race, you'll probably be unhappy, like me. Anyway, team time trial start the race off. Third day of the race, there's already a super hard climb in Andorra. That's very exciting for all of the Andorra podcasters out there. The race is going to go up to a climb at Arensal, an 8% finish after having done a hard Cat 1 climb in the run-up to it. That's on the third day, so I think we're going to see plenty of GC action right from the start. There's another really hard Category 1 climb on Stage 6. The race takes this kind of interesting route. They start out in the eastern part of Spain, Catalonia area, Andorra. They head down south to Cartagena, and then they head north. Stage 10 is a time trial, individual time trial, thankfully, in Valladolid, in north central Spain, and then they make their way in a roundabout fashion towards the north of Spain, stopping at the Col du Tourmalet. You may have heard that climb. Another very hard day, and then they finish with some very hard days, the Angleru climb, which is maybe the hardest climb that is routinely done in World Tour racing. It's that of the Zonkalan, right? I mean, super, super, super hard climb. And then things will eventually close out with, well, first a really, really, really challenging day of a bunch of hills on Stage 20, and then the sprinter stage in Madrid. All told, like I said, challenges are spread out across the whole course, which is great. You don't have to wait till the third week, although the third week is hard as heck. There is a team time trial to start it off. Bummer. There is a individual time trial in the middle. I would think that Remco Evenepoel, Primoz Roglic, and Jonas Vingegaard are all going to like their chances on those days.
Such a hater. Just because of your hatred of team time trials, your unfounded and slightly ridiculous hatred of team time trials, I will not be attending the stages in Andorra.
Wow, just for that? Wow. It's got nothing to do with any other reasons. I mean, look, if you want Jumbo Visma to already have a massive lead after the first stage, great. That doesn't really entice me to be interested in this week of racing that would otherwise be very entertaining as they go through beautiful Catalonia.
Hey, maybe it rains.
I could, I guess. Yeah, sure. I mean,
then it's chaos.
Couldn't you just give it an individual time trial so that we get actually individuals doing their thing rather than relying on their massive budget?
But then Remco has the lead, and nobody wants that.
What? Remco's dad, my favorite media source over the past month, probably wants that. All right. Let's talk about the favorites. I've already mentioned Remco and Roglic and Vingegaard. I think the big conversation here is, who is the actual leader? Jumbo said they're co-leaders.
Nope. Heard that before.
And I think Roglic, it's been clear he wanted to race the Vuelta all year. Whereas Vingegaard was sort of, at least publicly, we didn't know until after the tour. So I put this question to the crowd of two. Who do you think actually leads this team? Who is the better place finisher at the end of this race? I think we probably all agree that Jonas Vingegaard, at his best, is a better rider in the Grand Tours.
Yeah, but Roglic is going to be fresh.
That's what I'm wondering. I think the same.
What is Vingegaard going to be tired from? He's had a month off. Like,
is he in form? You know?
Oh my God, has it been a month since the tour? Jesus.
Well, because you have the TDFF at the end, the Tour de France Femme after the
original tour.
That's true,
which he did not race.
Yes.
Right, it feels like it was, time doesn't make sense. I mean, I still think that that's an interesting amount of time in between races when it comes to form. That's like so hit or miss. And the fact that the third week is arguably the hardest week of the tour means that it favors Roglic over Vingegaard because he might be able to semi-maintain that form going into the Vuelta, but it'll be a really long time to hold it all the way through the whole thing, especially depending on how it's raced. I feel like Roglic has the advantage here, but I also think, like, does it matter? It's Jumbo-Visma versus Remco. It doesn't matter which one. I don't know if it matters who of them is the leader. It might even be Sepp Kuss, for all we know. That guy's got to be tired AF at this point. My God.
Okay, I have a couple responses to what you just said. I'm sure they're saying it doesn't matter who the team leader is because that's what they're paid to say. But I want to know who the team leader is, first of all. Second of all, Sepp Kuss going into his third Grand Tour. What a beast.
Adam Mountain Stage Adam Hansen is basically like
his thing now. Exactly. And third, the bookies favor Vingegaard right now. And I am one with you, Abby. I kind of think Roglic is the guy. I mean, I know that Vingegaard, if he really, really, really wanted to win this race, would just blow everybody away. But he just raced the Tour. I don't think this was his bigger target this year. Obviously, it wasn't. The Tour was. Cosmo?
I'm curious as to why you would bring both of these riders to a single Grand Tour for any reason.
Funsies? Hey, they won the Tour that way.
I feel like both of them have sort of delivered thus far this season. Like, wouldn't this be a good opportunity to try and develop new talent? Or, you know, if one of them is super dialed and keyed in and ready to go and ready to win another Grand Tour, awesome. I feel like they're like almost like you're going through the fridge and you're like, oh, look at all these cool ingredients. I'm going to throw something together. And like, rather than having like a set meal that you're going to make with a set of ingredients that you already have planned out, weird metaphor, but like, I just, you know,
I like that metaphor.
I always kind of wonder when we have to wonder what the team's plan is, I have to wonder if they have a plan at all, or if it's just throw some cyclists into a race.
I think for Vingegaard, it has a little bit to do with going into a Grand Tour without a lot of pressure and just being able to race his bike. I don't think that he's going to have as much mental pressure in the Vuelta as he would the Tour, and that's one of the reasons that they have him going in. I also think that in terms of developing riders, that is... a Grand Tour is like no longer the place to do that, unfortunately, because of the way that bike racing is going these days. It's just getting harder and harder and faster, and every single race means so much now that they're not going to send like a younger rider to be their GC leader at a race like the Vuelta. It's going to be the Tour of Denmark. Like, it's just not going to happen. If Sepp had not just done both of the Grand Tours in support of Roglic and Vingegaard, then maybe he would have had a little bit of like, okay, let's see what Sepp can do as a GC leader. But I don't think Jumbo-Visma is going to look at the team and be like, okay, we have two of the best Grand Tour riders of the current time on our team. Who else can we develop it into a GC leader? They don't need to. They already have two of the best.
All right, taking on the Jumbo-Visma juggernaut. As I said, Remco Evenepoel, some of the other names. Juan Ayuso is the really interesting one to me. He finished, what is he, third last year at this race. He was very good this summer. Looked great at the Tour de Suisse. He's a great time trialist. This team in general knows how to win bike races. I mean, we know that about UAE. And he's got Jay Vine on the squad as well, which another very talented, strong rider. He's got Marc Soler, the most entertaining domestique in the peloton. Will he help you? Will he not?
Oh, man. That's so mean. It's true, but it's mean.
It's true, but it's very true. We've seen it on video enough that it's true. Joao Almeida also on that team. Enric Mas, Gary Thomas, a very interesting rider to watch. Richard Carapaz, who has done quite well at the Vuelta in the past. Yeah. Do any of these riders have a chance against the Jumbo-Visma juggernaut? Abby, you're shaking your head. Why not?
As I said, like, I really think it's just a Jumbo-Visma versus Remco, and that, like, maybe another rider is going to be able to sneak into the red jersey, kind of like Jai Hindley at the Tour, but when it comes down to it, it's going to be Jumbo-Visma and Remco at the end of the day. And I think, like, there's definitely some interesting riders, especially when you look at UAE, but I still don't think that teams are fielding the type of squad that could go up against the combination that is Roglic and Vingegaard.
I kind of hope things don't go as planned. I think this is a great start list. It's
Same.
A top start list. You know, we're not like wondering who's going to do well. Like, we know who the top names are, but I think at least for the last week of this Giro, the GC race was very entertaining because so much stuff went wrong and not according to plan through the first half of the first 2 weeks of the event. I sort of wouldn't mind seeing that here, but I think there are a lot of circumstances that this Giro had that the Vuelta is unlikely to have, particularly around weather. But I am leaning towards Evenepoel again. I think this is sort of his big objective for the season, minus, you know, the other things that he won handily. But this is, this is his chance to do stuff at a Grand Tour. He kind of was robbed of that at the Giro and was never scheduled to do it at the Tour. So I would expect him to maybe, I hate the phrase, but want it more than Roglic and Vingegaard and just the Jumbo team in general that's had a really good season, except for the Spring Classics, where they were good until they weren't, as Dan has pointed out many times.
Wanting it more. That's some sports talk radio right there.
Remco has had, by any standard, an amazing season. He is the world time trial champion. He made everyone else look like children at Liège. But the expectations on him are so high that it will almost be a disappointment if he doesn't win this. So
the problem with Remco is that he's not super tactically savvy. So I feel like up against like a two-pronged team like Jumbo, like he's gonna have a really hard time, especially if they, unfortunately for Dane, have like a foot up already when it comes to the TTT. All they have to do is just outsmart him on all the other stages, which is not going to be that hard for them.
Oof, shots fired, Abby.
No, it's something they like doing and have done successfully in the past, so...
Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean. I'm not dissing Remco. I'm just saying that they're very good at it.
Aren't you though? A little bit.
Yes.
A little bit.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
I like Roglic. Abby, do you like Roglic for Jumbo?
Yeah, I like Roglic for Jumbo.
All right. I do think Ayuso is the rider. I think he's the potential spoiler here. I mean, that's not like a big out of nowhere thing. He was third last year, but I think he's a very talented young rider. Someone to watch. And someone that I think Spanish fans can get behind. And also, impeccable English. Spent a lot of time living in the U.S., so I love hearing him in interviews. All right. Lots to look forward to with the Vuelta. We'll have plenty more Vuelta coverage, obviously, over at escapecollective.com. Last thing on the docket today.
I don't get to talk about Froome.
You want to talk about Froome?
Who?
I was just going to say that the Vuelta used to be the weird race that people who weren't ever going to win the Tour won. You know, you got your Zulas and your Chalaberts and your Sean Kellys, all former Vuelta winners. And then for some reason, Chris Froome kept coming back to the Vuelta with relatively limited success year after year after. He's out here winning the Tour de France handily, like making him kind of disliked, and yet he would show up with the Vuelta and try really hard to win it, and only managed to pull it off once after winning a Tour de France. He won it twice, but the first time was before he won the Tour.
Yeah.
That was his big, like, breakout. But I'm saying after he became Chris Froome as we knew him, he kept coming back and only managed to win it once.
Well, I think he was tired from the Tour. A great example of how this race has a great start list always.
Yeah, and very good racing. Like, it was great to watch him fight and not be super invincible. The start list we have now is sort of a legacy of that. That's all I want to say.
I agree. Thanks, Chris Froome, for that legacy. All right. That's the Vuelta. Let's look ahead to the other race, the other big race. There's one other one I'm going to spend about 5 seconds on. Abby, let's talk Tour Scandinavia, though. What's coming up at the Tour Scandinavia?
Tour Scandinavia starts on the 23rd of August in Norway. There's three stages in Norway, two stages in Denmark. The first stage is a road race with a couple little poppy climbs at the end, but is most likely going to be like a sprint. It looks like the second stage is the first of the GC stages with the climb that has been in the Tour of Scandinavia / the Tour of Norway for a couple years. And it was the climb that Cecilie Uttrup-Ludvig won the whole race on last year, so that makes its return in the second stage. Usually it's a little bit later on in the race, but earlier this year, stage three has a couple really fun little category two, category one climbs in it. It's also Norway stage. And then for the stage four time trial, 16.5K time trial, they move over to Denmark. Pretty straightforward time trial, nothing too exciting there. There's like some lumps, but like, just your standard highway overpass type thing. Not very technical, start and finish in the same place. And only 16K. So an interesting distance for a time trial within a stage race, within a World Tour race. And then stage five is the final stage in Denmark with a couple circuits to finish it off. Very exciting.
They don't go to Sweden at all. And
originally, when the concept for the race was thrown around, it was kind of a merging of the Tour of Norway and the Vegarda Classic. Yeah, but then the Vegarda Classic pulled out, and then subsequently quit women's cycling. And what we got was a Tour of Scandinavia that's actually just Norway and Denmark.
Yeah, I just feel like they're really close to Sweden at one point. Just like dip in for.
I think that they kind of went like over the border last year for a little bit, but like there wasn't a stage that finished or started in Sweden last year either.
I feel as a completionist that they need to visit Sweden purely to call themselves the Tour of Scandinavia. That's all I ask. All right. Who's going to be there, Abby?
Well, the start list is thin and far between, but we do know that Annemiek van Vleuten will line up one of her last two races of her career. So really just enjoying every second we have with her while we still have her. So she will be there with her teammate Emma Norsgaard, who wasn't able to race last year because she had a broken collarbone from the Tour de France Femmevik Zwift. So really excited to see Emma racing a World Tour race on home soil. That's going to be pretty exciting. And that last stage looks awesome for her. Jaco Alula is the only other team with a confirmed roster so far on this fine Sunday evening, and that includes Ruby Roseman-Gannon, which is exciting, and St. Esteban, who is riding super well at the Tour, especially climbing really well, and Urska Zegart, who had a great Tour de Suisse. So, unfortunately, not a lot of other riders on the start list, but Cecilie Uttrup-Ludvig will also be lining up for FDJ. I don't know who will support her, though, but the defending champion of the race. So, yeah, I think it's going to be a really good one. There's a lot of riders that didn't race the Tour that are still hungry for something, and a lot of riders that are just really looking forward to beating SC Works.
This is sort of a random thought, but August is a really good time to be a Scandinavian cycling fan. You get Denmark, you get the Arctic Race in Norway, you get Tour Scandinavia. You get people from Scandinavia just winning races even if they're not in Scandinavia, like Mads Pedersen in Hamburg. A Norwegian guy won a Tour de Lavender stage today. Yeah. Anyway, August, great time to be Norwegian or Dane. Last point I'm going to make before I close out the show. Why can't the bike race that used to be called the Enigo Tour just call itself one name and give the sponsor a shout out in the name as well? Because the Renewy Tour, can it be the Renewy Benelux Tour or the Enigo Benelux Tour? Because your race is just never going to get cachet. There's some pretty good riders that are going to this race this week. Jasper Philipsen, Arno Dali, Matej Mohoric, Dylan Groenewegen, Arno Demar, all these people are on the provisional start list. Can't you just come up with a name and stick with it and give the sponsor a shout out? It's not that hard. Okay, rant over and podcast over.
Oh, wow. That was abrupt.
Yeah. That's it. That's all you get. All
right. Well,
did you have other thoughts today, Abby?
It just seems like you should close out the podcast with like a little bit more of like a soothing segment than a rant.
Ease us down.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Like you got to like wrap it up, put like a pretty bow on it or something. You can't just like rant and.
I got you. All right. Let me see what I can do there. Okay. All right. Rant over. Please go listen to the Wheel Talk podcast and also with the Vuelta España coming up, starting in eastern Spain, in the Catalonia region, you could consider sipping on a Priorat wine. It's delicious. It's pretty high in alcohol, so it'll be a nice way to come down a little bit from this ranty end that I've given this podcast. And again, go listen to the Wheel Talk podcast later this week. Listen to Placeholders. Listen to Geek Warning. And when you've done all of that, go sign up at escapecollective.com/join. Thanks very much, everybody, for listening to the Pretty Serious Bike Racing Podcast. Abby, Cosmo, it's been great talking to you.
Thanks,
Dan. Great talking with you, Dan. That was wonderful, by the way.
Thank you. Thanks very much. We'll see you next week.